Episodes in accordance for the wheelchair audience. You don't want to miss any audio clips, cause we're providing information, tips and some tricks for every state and every nation. Someone can benefit, like, what's the best fabric? Should I get the tiger's yellow carbon fiber palette?
Welcome to Wheelchair Nerds, a podcast to connect and inform people who utilize, prescribe, and provide seating and wheel mobility equipment. I'm your host, Angie Kiger. Before we jump into today's topic, a brief reminder that the information in this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not intended to be medical, billing, or legal advice. Now, let's get to it. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Wheelchair Nerds. It is the summer of 2024. We've now hit June. Amazing. The weather here in the DC metro area is hot. We are looking at like 90 degrees, hot and steamy here in Northern Virginia. So I love summer. I love summer because I think about travel. I think about being outside. I've always been a person who loves to drive the back roads. And driving has always been a very big part of my life. I'm a big road tripper. I am someone who, when I get stressed, like I said, I put the windows down, pump up the music, and just go for a drive. And a lot of times, working with folks who have disabilities, have physical disabilities, or have been injured, driving is something that either if they were driving prior to, say, an accident, something that they strive to get back to, or either have a congenital disability and just physically have not been able to drive or had the experience of driving at all, and may think it's not possible. However, there is a lot of great technology that is out there related to driving. And just, I think, so a topic that folks who maybe live in more rural areas aren't aware of, and maybe that aren't tied to a rehab center as far as getting resources and whatnot on driving. So we decided to phone a friend and bring in some folks from the Shepherd Center. And I reached out to one of my good friends down at Shepherd, and I was like, hey, I'd love to do a podcast on driving. She recommended this individual we have as our guest today. And then a coworker who actually used to work at Shepherd also recommended Matt. So with all that said, excited to have Matt. I'm going to call you a driving expert or content expert today. Hopefully that's okay. We're excited to have Matt on the podcast joining us. So Matt, I always ask people, like, give me your quick little elevator pitch, right? When it comes to, like, you know, who are you? What do you do? Why are you an expert in this content?
Okay. Yeah. My name is Matt Abasamra, and I'm an occupational therapist, and I'm also a certified driver rehab specialist. And I've been working in the adaptive disabled driving industry for, it's probably 18 years now. And I've been an occupational therapist since 2001. I'm a supervisor of the driving department at Shepherd Center, which is a large, I think the largest spinal rehab center in the United States. And I've been there since 2004. And I work with all types of clients with any type of medical situation that might affect your ability to drive. I like to say the gamut is, you know, I'll work with a 15-year-old who's grown up with cerebral palsy up to a 98-year-old. I don't think I've ever had anyone over 100, you know, maybe with senility or Alzheimer's or stuff like that. But like, and everything in between, amputations, paralysis, cognitive, visual, hearing, sensory, anxiety, all sorts of issues, that anything that might affect driving. And I'm very fortunate where I work. We have all different types of vehicles, with not every piece of equipment in the entire industry, but most of the equipment that's in the industry. And I would think if anyone can drive the equipment we have something for you to allow you to drive if you are able to drive.
Awesome. So as an OT, what led you to specializing in this? You know, like we think a lot about, like, my friends that are OTs. I've got a friend of mine who ran a feeding management program. I've got an OT friend of mine who is an expert in working in schools and doing school-based interventions. And of course, I know a whole lot of wheelchair nerds that are OTs. But when it came to driving rehab, what drew you to that as a specialty for your clinical practice?
Well, I was an occupational therapist at a general rehab hospital in Massachusetts originally, and they needed someone to help kind of conduct the clinical aspect to screen people for driving. And I just helped out a little bit with that. And, you know, some of the people who were more into the driving program there encouraged me to keep looking into it. And then in 2004, I moved to Atlanta, and I was an occupational therapist on the inpatient rehab side of Shepherd Center for spinal cord patients. And an opening came up in the driving department. And I thought, well, it seems interesting. I'll try this. a little less bowel and bladder stuff to work with. So I tried it, and here I am 18 years later. I love it. It's awesome. I get to hang out with people in the car every day, you know, all sorts different types of people from different walks of life. And every client I see is different than the client beforehand. And it's a fun job. A lot of times people tell me, I could never do your job, you know, because, you know, you're driving around Atlanta with folks with all any sort of disability. And I'm like, good, I don't want you to do my job. So
I love it. So at the beginning of the podcast, I mentioned I reached out to some of my friends down at the Shepherd Center, Matt. And you of course, are co-workers with Robin Skolsky, a good friend of mine who's a PT who works in the wheelchair clinic at the Shepherd Center. And of course, Jenith, who now works at Permobil in our scientific affairs department. So you've worked with those guys as wheelchair nerds. So Matt, a question for you. When it comes to wheelchairs, right? We're looking at power wheelchairs, looking at manual wheelchairs. How closely do you need to know that and have an understanding of that equipment? Like, do you work closely with folks like Robin on the team at Shepherd to make sure you're on top of what is happening with the wheelchair technology? And I guess, what are the differences or what are some considerations if someone comes to you and says, I've got a power wheelchair versus a manual wheelchair? Just give me some, you know, can somebody who drives a power wheelchair, can they drive themselves or do they need to be in a manual chair? What does this look like?
Oh, no, they can definitely drive themselves. Like, you can make the argument, it might be more expensive to drive using a power wheelchair, but it might in some ways be easier. But yeah, either type of wheelchair can be used for driving purposes. What you really have to think about is if the person using the wheelchair needs the wheelchair once they drive to where they're getting, like going to, how are they going to get that wheelchair in and out of the vehicle and get their self in and out of the wheelchair if they have to get in and out of the wheelchair? So a lot of folks, if they're using manual wheelchairs, can maybe transfer to the driver's seat and then reach back out and disassemble a manual wheelchair and pull it in across them. There are minivans and pickup trucks that have cranes that can pull in a manual wheelchair or maybe a lighter power chair. There are some folks who can walk a little bit and maybe they could use some sort of lift in the back of a vehicle, whether it's something that holds a wheelchair outside the vehicle or pulls it into a rear hatch. And then for a lot more money, there are vehicles that allow you to drive a wheelchair right into a vehicle. They're typically minivans, but there's also some SUVs and pickups that allow you to push or drive your power chair right into a vehicle. And some of these vehicles allow you to drive while you're sitting in the wheelchair. And some people will transfer from their wheelchair to a adaptive driver's seat.
Gotcha. So is there any sort of like standard of safety, right? Like, because I have a friend of mine who has driven in both his manual chair and his power chair. I believe, I'd have to double check with him. I believe now he has one of those SUVs where he can drive into it, one of the newer models. I think he got it last year. But previously he was driving from his pickup truck and he used power assist on a manual wheelchair. And he had one of those lifts that, you know, he would go obviously from the ground all the way up to the driver's seat. But I'm just curious, is there one versus the other that is considered the standard of safety? Because I get that question a lot when people are talking about their wheelchairs, because especially right around, I used to do clinical education and I did a class on teens and tweens. And, you know, developmentally, everybody thinks when they start to become a teenager, right, like they're going to get their set of wheels and be independent and drive. And so parents would reach out and say, well, can my kid drive? Like, what are the safety things that would go there?
Well, if you're thinking about strictly the wheelchair, not any other safety things, last I checked on most wheelchairs manufacturers' websites, they say something like, this wheelchair is not to, no one's supposed to sit in the wheelchair and ride in a vehicle while sitting in the wheelchair. Well, they say that as a CYA type of thing, because obviously, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people ride in their wheelchairs every day, probably more than that. So technically, that's what the wheelchair manufacturer is telling you. You're not supposed to ride in the wheelchair while in a vehicle. But of course, everyone does it. And the wheelchair manufacturers also like offer places to put straps on the wheelchair, you know, to secure it during transport. And there are other companies that build and install automatic locks to hold the wheelchair in place. All right. Typically, we kind of think it's better or safer to be in a power wheelchair because it's sturdier. And usually we'll have a hard back and a headrest. But there are ways around that. If you're in a manual chair and you're going to drive from the manual chair, they have headrest and backrest that swing in around behind you and offer some neck and back support. But, you know, it's a gray area. And I think a lot of people who do my job don't want it to be overly regulated to not allow people to drive, you know?
Yeah, I think when it comes to wheelchair manufacturers, I always tell people this. always read the fine print in terms of if a chair says that it has been transit tested or transit approved. There are various standards. There's some that are international standards. There's some that, you know, folks think of like WC19. But the other thing to read is when it is in text, make sure that you are seeing a text, meaning the writing in the owner's manual and safety precautions, that it has been occupant tested. That's always a big thing, because sometimes people will go for a wheelchair based on, hey, these tie downs were free, look at this. But then when you read the fine print, it's like, wait, it wasn't occupant tested. And so that's a little bit, you know, it's just another thing for folks to think about when choosing your pieces of equipment. But in general, Matt, what you're telling me is there are ways for folks, whether you use a manual wheelchair and you'd like to drive from the manual wheelchair, or you'd like to transfer to a seat, or if you drive a power wheelchair full time and transferring is not even an option for you at all, there are ways for you to get behind the wheel and to be able to make that vehicle go in a safe manner with the right technology and training. Okay.
Yeah. We can hop off what we were just talking about in a second. But, you know, some wheelchairs are crash tested, but they usually crash test them with the very basic seating system that comes with them. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you switch out for a higher end armrest or different headrest, that wheelchair is technically not crash tested anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many factors. I always tell people, I'm like, talk with your individual experts, talk with your driving specialist before making those hard and fast decisions. And I think that anybody that you work with, the goal is independence and safety for you. So don't count it out, right? Like, make sure that you're reading and talking and interacting with the appropriate professionals. You know, and with that said, appropriate professionals, how do people find someone such as yourself? I mean, you're in Atlanta. We know that that's a big metropolitan area. So how do people find out about your program? How long does it take? I'm sure you've got, you know, Georgia's has a pretty big reach. You guys touch Alabama, you touch, you know, all sorts of other states in that area. There are some pretty rural areas down there.
How you would find someone like myself, I'm a CDRS certified driving specialist. The correct answer is to go to ADED.net, ADED. It's like added, except one less D in the middle. And you find a CDRS or similar by putting in your state and see if there's people like me in your state. Not every state has a CDRS. Most do. And if you couldn't find someone local to you, the next step would be find someone who installs the driving equipment. And you could probably do that from a Google search, but you could also look up the people who are most accredited to install the equipment at NMEDA, Nancy, Mary, Eric, David, Apple. And those are the dealers, and they are in every state for people who install the hand controls or whatever it is you need to drive. And they could tell you, yeah, we're here in Wyoming. There's not a CDRS, but here's who does it here, or here's the process here to get you most safe and hopefully get you the right equipment to drive.
Gotcha. Very cool. Okay, so let's talk about someone reaches out to you down, or actually, you know, before I let me backtrack a little bit. Is there anything that is considered, you know, by law that someone has in order to be, you know, we know that obviously to get your driving permit, there are various things that you have to be able to meet for if you don't have physical disabilities. But what are some of the guidelines? I mean, right now, like I wear glasses, so I know the only restriction I have on my license is that I've got to make sure I have glasses or contacts in. But what are the laws around this when it comes to driving with a disability?
Good question. I do work in multiple states. And every state is different. Some states have their rules and they don't follow them. Other states are extremely strict about what you can do. If I had to like generalize, you know, what are most states, what are their rules as far as driving with adaptive equipment? Typically, you have to learn how to drive with the adaptive equipment, let's say with somebody like me, and then have your doctor send each state usually has a form or a letter that the doctor sends in to the DMV in your own state or whoever regulates driver licensing. And when the DMV gets this medical report from your doctor, they register it and they say, okay, you can come take a test at one of our sites, just the regular test that a 16-year-old would take. And you take it with the equipment. And then when you pass the test, they issue you a license with restriction. And different states have different restrictions. A lot of states just use a generic term like mechanical aids to include hand controls, left foot accelerators, joysticks, whatever. Because, you know, the state licensing boards don't know the different types of equipment that people would drive with.
So gotcha.
It's a process. Yeah. And different states are apply those rules more or less strictly than other states. So
true. So it has been my experience when I've gone to adult rehab facilities, that most of the folks in those facilities are like yourself, they're occupational therapists, but who can become an instructor and who do you, who might someone, so if we have OTs and PTs listening, I'm like, hey, this sounds like an interesting profession. I kind of want to go down this. Or you've also got individuals who are looking to go to a clinic or go somewhere. What's the background of the instructors typically?
A lot of them are occupational therapists like myself, mm-hmm. who then went through that group ADED that I listed a little while ago, ADED.net, mm-hmm. and either did it's basically, I think you have to do a full-time year of training in the industry. It doesn't have to happen over 1 year, and then you can sit for a credentialing examination, and then you have to get continuing education to keep that credential up.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any ballpark idea of how many different credentialed folks there are out there in the U.S.?
Yes. My answer used to be 300 to that question. Mm-hmm. And I feel like now we're closer to 500.
Oh, wow. That's a lot more than I would have guessed, to be honest with you. I have lived in a larger metropolitan area for 24 years now. So I think about like when I'm back home in Lynchburg, Virginia, I have no idea where people would go, Lynchburg, where I grew up. So no, that's actually interesting. Now, Ken, so for your experience, if someone, I know that Atlanta and the Shepherd Center being such a large and well-known model facility, and of course, there's other model facilities out there, Colorado, of course, we all think of Craig, we think of McGee up in the Northeast, and of course, Rancho Los Amigos out on the West, but when someone is, when do they typically come in, meaning if someone's an acquired injury, we'll talk mm-hmm. about more of a congenital diagnosis later on, but an acquired injury, when does driver's rehab typically fall into the mix? Is it an inpatient thing? Is it a part of their outpatient program, post-inpatient discharge? Like where do you get involved if someone wants to drive?
Good question. And different people who do my job might give you a different answer, but obviously my answer is right. So don't worry about that. No, it depends on, if we're talking spinal cord injury, it depends on the injury, of course, right? Mm-hmm. And how well they can function. I don't see many inpatients. We used to, but inpatient stays have become shorter and shorter for, mm-hmm. I'm just talking spinal cord here. But our general rule for the inpatients, for someone who's in a manual wheelchair, if they tell me I plan on taking my manual wheelchair in my sedan mm-hmm. or my pickup, they just have to prove to me that they can get that wheelchair into their sedan or pickup. Mm-hmm. I live in the South, so that's why I say pickup, right?
Yeah.
And if they can't, I say, you either have to plan to get more adaptations to get the wheelchair in and out of a different type of vehicle for yourself, or keep working on your rehab until you can get that manual wheelchair in. Mm-hmm. Because it's really easy to learn how to drive, especially if you have both arms functioning and you already know how to drive. Mm-hmm. But I don't want this person on the pavement in a huge Walmart parking lot in 95 degree Atlanta weather because someone gave them equipment, but they really weren't independent safely to get themselves and their wheelchair in and out of a vehicle. So that's kind of our cutoff for the folks who are, let's say, paraplegics. They can move their arms, probably have decent trunk balance, as long as they can get their wheelchair in and out relatively well. Mm-hmm. For our folks who have cervical spinal cord injuries, where all four limbs are affected to some degree, we typically tell them to wait a year to a year and a half. And again, this is talking about someone with a spinal cord injury who just suffered this injury. Because mm-hmm. even if they don't get return from their spinal injury, like more nerves innervated, just mm-hmm. the muscles they have, they're going to get stronger even without a spinal cord recovery of any type. And they're going to know how to balance their body better, which is really big in relation to driving. And how to use those. I tell them, you have new arms now and you need to learn how to use these arms. Hmm. So by waiting, they're going to need less equipment to drive. Driving is going to feel more normal and it's going to cost less money. And they're going to have more options on what type of vehicles they can have and what kind of chair or mobility device they can take with them.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Now, what about somebody, you mentioned that you work with folks with all different diagnoses. So even mm-hmm. though the Shepherd Center really is a model facility for TBI, for spinal cord injury, it sounds like, and I recall this from talking with my friends that work in the wheelchair clinic there, is that y'all aren't necessarily limited by what diagnosis you have when seen at the Shepherd Center. But what are some of the, I guess, give me, an example of like a super complex situation where maybe everyone else was like, there's no way this person's going to be able to drive a vehicle. Love to hear that.
Well, there's two different ways you can look at your question. One are, let's say you have someone with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy or mm-hmm. spinal muscular atrophy, and they have very little movement, but they can still drive their wheelchair with a joystick of some type. Mm-hmm. I love working with those type of folks because we're fortunate enough to have some really expensive evaluation vehicles that you can drive with. I'm just going to simplify it. You can drive it with a joystick that's in the vehicle. And that's a lot of fun. And just because these folks, you know, haven't had a lot of independence in their life. And now they're like anyone else on the road. They're like their brother who got his license when he was 16. And so folks like that who have real severe physical weakness, you know, kind of classified, you know, some with C5 quadriplegia, some with Duchenne's MD, some with SMA, et cetera. It's more just a funding thing for high-tech driving equipment. And as far as difficult diagnoses that are difficult to drive with, like really, really, like folks, when you see that diagnosis on a piece of paper, you know it's going to be, you know, 80 hours of training for this person to be able to drive one or two places. I'd say folks with cerebral palsy, I think most people who do my job would say that CP is maybe the toughest diagnosis to drive with. Mm-hmm. It just takes a massive amount of patience and training and a lot of hard work by the client.
But not saying for if we've got folks that have CP or you have a child with CP that's listening to this podcast, and not saying it's impossible.
It just, I've got three people this year, their licenses, who have CP.
Mm-hmm. There's, I mean, in some principles, so before I joined working for a manufacturer, this is my second manufacturer I've worked for in my career, but before I joined a manufacturer, I ran an alternative input device drive clinic, but I worked with folks in our assistive technology and our power mobility clinic and ran our power mobility evaluations. And you're right. When it comes to CP, that startle response, it can be difficult to come up with different compensatory strategies and to address the tone that may kick in. And it's not impossible for driving a power wheelchair. And I can imagine the same, not the exact same principles, but kind of the same concept. Like it's not impossible to drive a motor vehicle either.
It is not. No, it is not. A lot of times, like maybe a difference between a wheelchair and driving a vehicle, depending on how much movement this person has. Mm-hmm. If you can use two limbs to drive, whether it's a foot and one arm or two arms, those are typically your choices. The cost of driving equipment goes down massively than if you could just use one limb. But sometimes folks, and I might be making up this word, but I say they have trouble disassociating their foot. Like when their foot moves, their hand wants to move. Mm-hmm. Or if their foot is doing little fine motor movements, but the arm has to do big gross motor movements on the steering wheel. It's hard for folks with certain diagnoses. And that's just something that takes time and practice. But it can be done. And I know I've been doing this 18 years. And I probably, when I was started, I would have thought it was near impossible. And now I just kind of look at it as a challenge and something that, oh boy, this is going to be great if we have success. So,
yeah. And this is a pretty broad question because I used to have families would ask this. I worked at a pediatric hospital and families would ask me all the time, okay, well, how long is it going to take for my child to learn how to drive a power wheelchair? But I would always say, well, it depends. You know, everybody's an individual. So I guess what would you say is the average sort of average length of stay from being an inpatient therapist, but average driving time, your driving program? I'm sure you guys have a wait list and all that sort of stuff, but as you're going through your wait list and someone calls up, is like, hey, I want to do this. What is the, I guess, how often can somebody come in for training and how long until they quote unquote graduate from the program?
Okay. It is completely diagnosis dependent. Okay. And sometimes the funding is the major holdup, especially if they need high tech driving equipment. Vocational rehab is the biggest funding source for that I know of. And you know, typically folks work on it for over a year to get the funding. But then as far as when you're all ready, you have your funding, you might have your vehicle, lined up. It really depends. Is it someone who was the 35-year-old who was already driving and now they can't use their legs, but their arms work fine? I think I do it as probably, or the Shepherd does it as quickly as anyone else in the industry. Mm-hmm. And we, for someone who already has a driver's license, has a fully functioning upper body, we can really get them knocked out in two visits. One visit in our evaluation vehicle and the other visit in their vehicle where we make sure they're safe to drive their own vehicle and make sure their equipment's installed correctly. For someone who needs the high-tech equipment, you know, once all our ducks in a row, funding, everything, we'd like to do a whole week of training and followed by a week of training in their own vehicle. So that's like a two-week process. For a new driver, depending on the disability, we would do a week of training, like intensive training, 20 hours, 1 week, take their license test on Friday of that week, and then do another 20 hours in their own vehicle. For folks who have like coordination or vision issues, you know, we could do 80 hours with them. And then hopefully graduate them to kind of drive with their family in their own car. So it's really diagnosis dependent.
Okay. So what does, I guess, what's the capacity? How many clients do you typically have on your caseload at Shepherd? I mean, are you doing back-to-back sessions, you know, every day? Or I guess, what does your typical day look like?
Good question. I have two types of typical days. We do a lot of evaluations, and a lot of our clients don't use equipment. They're driving a regular car, and I'm either checking them off from a cognitive or vision standpoint. But I'll do like three evaluations a day where I'll take a clinical look at somebody. We take a look at their arms, their legs, their vision, their thinking, their mobility device, if they have one, talk about their vehicle, and then go out in the car and or van or whatever and evaluate their driving or teach them how to use controls. And I'll do three of those evaluations a day. And then, like, for instance, this week, I'm working with a young lady who has driven half an hour, which was with me before this week. And we're doing a 20-hour training week. So I see her all day, each day. And hopefully on Friday, we will go take her license test if she's ready. And if she's not, we'll do another 20-hour training week.
Okay.
So, and I enjoy the training weeks usually, just because, you know, you get to hang out with someone all week. And they go from, like, this girl this week, we were crawling through a neighborhood yesterday at like 5 miles an hour. And my hand is constantly on the steering wheel helping her steer. And today, the next day, we were driving 60 miles an hour on a highway. Wow. So like
in Atlanta.
Yeah. A little bit outside Atlanta, but yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. That's
you can't drive 60 miles in Atlanta because traffic doesn't move that fast.
It's true. I've driven through that many a time. As someone who used to commute into Washington, D.C. from Virginia, I feel the big metropolitan area pain when it comes to traffic, that's for sure. So one of the things that you mentioned, and I for years, I've always said this for the wheelchair industry or complex rehab technology industry, it sounds like it's the same thing for your industry of driving, but funding is literally the F word of our industry.
yes, I like that. I've never heard that. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, no, feel free. I mean, it really is. It is something, because so I'm sure it's understandably different for folks that are coming into seeking driving, right? Like, even, I mean, I'm just even like kind of slowing down and kind of pondering, like, as someone without disabilities, it is my responsibility to purchase my vehicle and to maintain my insurance, to maintain my vehicle. Like, those are just average costs. But of course, for someone with a disability, there's even more.
Oh, yeah.
Things that are required. So my question is, I guess, for you, what are some funding avenues? You mentioned vocational rehab. How does voc rehab work? As I think that is sometimes something that people don't necessarily think about as an option, because you hear the word vocational, they think, oh, this is getting me back to work. But how does funding work for the typical individual who's coming to see you for driving?
Okay. A lot of driving is self-pay, but for the high-tech driving stuff, really, not many regular people can pay for that type of equipment. Like, to drive with a joystick, you're talking $60,000 for the driving equipment, not for the accessible van, but for the actual driving equipment. So vocational rehab is the biggest funding source for that. Vocational rehab is in every state, and their goal is that people with disabilities become employed and therefore, you know, typically pay income taxes by being employed and maybe get off partially off disability, but they provide you funding to get you to where you can become employed. And a lot of times you have to drive to work. So they will typically, I can't speak for every state or every case, but if you need an adapted van, let's say you need a Toyota sedan, a Toyota minivan that has the lowered floor and the ramp, which is a big cost upgrade to a Toyota. You have to buy the Toyota yourself. But they pay for the portion that covers it being adapted, which is called the lowered floor. They make the floor lower so the door is tall enough to drive your wheelchair in. And they will pay for your driving equipment, and they will pay for your driver training as well.
Okay. I think that's a nice option that people might not necessarily realize. I'm sure that I've seen, like, my sister-in-law is an internist, and I remember when she works in a rural part of North Carolina. And she was asking me about, like, GoFundMes and how that sort of stuff works. And of course, I'm always like, well, you know, always check in with the professionals working with this, you know, with this client and all this stuff. Because, I mean, there is obviously crowdsourcing that's available. But for some folks, I think funding is probably one of the largest obstacles they will encounter when it comes to driving.
No doubt. Absolutely. I can't necessarily recommend one group over another, but I typically would tell our folks at Shepherd Center that there is a thing called, there are like nonprofits that are similar to GoFundMe, where if people donate to you via this nonprofit, they can take it off their taxes and you don't have to pay taxes on what you fundraise. We use helphopelive.org, sorry. Okay. But I'm sure they're not the only organization out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So you mentioned, you know, we're looking at equipment options, right? So let's talk specifically about driving and making the car go from point A to point B. And then, of course, you know, what other technologies are in terms of other functions like windows, doors, radios, all that sort of stuff? How does all of that work when it comes to operating a vehicle? What are the, you mentioned for someone with pretty severe physical impairments that you can drive with just a little joystick that is possible. But what are the other typical ways that someone might be controlling everything or interfacing with everything in their vehicle?
Okay. Yeah, there's options from low tech to high tech. And now with newer cars, like they do a lot of the stuff for you that you used to have to pay money to have adaptive equipment for. For instance, now like some cars will put the park brake on themselves or you just press a button for it. Mm-hmm. You used to have to pay for a $2,000 motor with a button to do that. So I'm going to try to break it down into different categories as far as what you're asking. You have your primary controls, which are steering and the gas and brake. We'll start with the gas and brake. The gas and brake can be operated with a hand control, which to simplify it again, is a stick that you move in one of two directions. And that stick either applies the gas or the brake. Sometimes the force you need to put on that stick is too much for folks, so they need a motor to assist with the gas and brake. So then pushing on whatever control you have for the gas and brake, it's less physical work, it's less range or less reaching, but it's going to cost a lot more. Mm-hmm. As far as steering, they can put like handles. We've all seen that ball on the steering wheel to help you turn mm-hmm. the steering wheel with one hand. And sometimes the folks, even with a ball or a different type of handle, that allows you to move the wheel without having actual finger function. Even sometimes that's too difficult to turn power steering. They can take out your steering rack and make that steering five times easier to turn. It's a big process. They send your steering rack to California or New York or maybe another place and adjust the resistance on the steering wheel and send it back and it's reinstalled in your car. For some folks, that is too hard and you actually have a little control like a joystick that will use a motor to spin the regular steering wheel with. And that's hard to learn how to drive because it's so sensitive, but it does allow people with minimal strength and range to turn their steering wheel. As far as the other things, like what we call secondary controls, turn signals, windows, wipers, horn, bright light, cruise control, sometimes they can put little extensions on the buttons or the dials or switches, like just 3D printed little extensions. And then you might have a button, like a jelly bean type button that cycles through different commands. Like you hold down the button and it will beep 1 through 6 times. And if you let the beep off on the first time, it's your left turn signal. If you let it beep all the way to 6, it's your horn, et cetera. And then they also have touchscreens that are installed in the car where you can reach them that can shift, park, reverse, neutral, drive, windows, HVAC, everything. The more your controls do, they have motors, if they have electronics, the more they're going to cost, but the less function they require to use.
Cool. So, I mean, it sounds like there is definitely a range, as you mentioned, with everything when it comes to assistive technology. There's low tech, no tech, to all the way up to high tech. And of course, unfortunately, the way the world works and the F word works is that the more high tech it is, it typically increases that that price tag. But there are options. So I think, Matt, we covered a lot of really interesting things today regarding setting someone up for success, getting them evaluated, knowing who to go to, where to go to find someone who can help them with an evaluation, and then really starting out the whole, you know, planting the seeds as far as what's available for funding. It is next to impossible to get into all the details on a podcast episode, but this one we really wanted to make sure we tailor to someone who was wanting to learn how to drive and a therapist who maybe had a client who was wanting to help their client be able to drive and to be independent with transportation mobility, once again, driving a vehicle. If you're cool with it, I would love to have you back for another episode at some point later this summer to talk about what goes into selecting a vehicle or what vehicle options are out there for someone who is going to be the passenger in a vehicle where we know that driving for whatever reason is not an option for them, whether it's their family situation or it is physical or cognitive or sensory impairment. I mean, how best to transport, you know, when it looks at like, we've talked about vans, SUVs, like what's out there, tie downs outside, all that kind of stuff. So hopefully we'll be able to circle back up before it gets too late in the summer and into the fall, but and have another conversation about that, because I think that that driving and just transportation and mobility in general for folks with disabilities often comes with a lot of questions. And I've always looked at it as being adjacent to the complex rehab technology side of things, the wheelchair stuff. So love the fact that we made this connection. That's what this whole podcast is all about. I do have to ask you one last question that I didn't prompt you about. I didn't tell you about it, but I love to ask people who are guests, what makes you a wheelchair nerd?
I know a lot about wheelchairs. Yeah. My office is right next door to our seating clinic. And, you know, I'm always having people drive from their wheelchair. So I kind of know a lot about what, we didn't even get into this, what parts of wheelchairs make driving more difficult.
Oh my gosh.
Spoiler. It's, or any chair that has suspension. That chair, especially if you're driving with a sensitive piece of equipment, a little electric hand control, those chairs bounce a lot while you're moving and while you're trying to operate a tiny little control. So I do know a lot about wheelchair stability and stuff like that. But hopefully, I've signed an NDA about this, but there's hopefully a product coming out within a year that's going to solve the wheelchairs bouncing around while folks are driving. So
That can be like a spoiler alert teaser for like maybe in 2025, we have you come back and do another
one. Hopefully I have something. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, to let people know about this. I have been to Shepherd many times. Now I have an excuse now that I know somebody on your side of things. Like I know Leah down there. I know all sorts of folks at Shepherd. I need to make an excuse just to come over and check out your cars and stuff the next time I'm down in the ATL and come and hang out for a bit.
Absolutely.
So anyway, Matt, thank you so much for just being open to this. I know that everyone is super crazy busy in their lives, and these podcasts are always fun to do because we learn so much and just bring folks together. As I said, I firmly believe that people who utilize, prescribe, and provide wheelchairs all need to be aware of these topics we talk about. So thanks so much, and we will talk to you again soon, hopefully.
All right. Hey, thank you for letting me live out my dream of being on a podcast. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to Wheelchair Nerds, presented by ProMobile. Today's episode was brought to you by...
You deserve a manual wheelchair that's as unique as you are. ProMobile's Creative Mobility Division helps you make that happen with simple solutions for your positioning and mobility needs. Fit, function, and fashion, we've got you covered, with over 90 custom options for your tie light. Take customization to the next level and don't be afraid to think outside of the order form. Just one more way that ProMobile innovates for individuals.
Thanks for checking out this episode. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single one. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @WheelchairNerds. And tell your friends about our podcast too. Oh, and we really appreciate it if you give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment sharing what your favorite thing about Wheelchair Nerds is. Last but not least, if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss or know a great guest, hey, it could even be you. You could be that next great guest. Send us an email. Tell us why. You can reach us at wheelchairnerds@permobile.com or DM us on one of our social platforms. We love hearing from you. The wheelchair nerds, like the wheelchair nerds.